Beit HaRamash to Chof Kimmel Av Tov Shinein Zayin, Rabbi Yomi Simmons.
Okay, so thank you for asking me to speak here again. So it's about a year ago I did it. So, okay, so the topic that I want to speak about this morning is something that I'm particularly something interesting, particularly for me, which is the concept, the question. It's not a one one Shia talk, but we'll make a start on the idea. That's the subject of DNA in halacha. About 3 months ago, I was told, I asked MD and he told me that no one had spoken about this before. So, is that correct? Yeah. Okay, so, I was in 3 months ago, I was at in Amsterdam for the Conference of European Rabbis, and this is one of the major, the issue of Jewish identity was one of the main topics at the conference, because of, if you can set the background of what is going on in Europe, that especially in Eastern Europe, there are thousands and thousands of people that are coming forward claiming Jewish identity. It's absolutely inspiring to see what is going on in Russia and Lithuania, Latvia, all these countries. And there was over 100 rabbis attending this conference from the former Soviet Union, and some of whom have now moved into Germany. So the issue is a real issue for them. It's also, as we'll see, an issue in many areas of halacha as well. On a lighter note, this was a 60th anniversary conference, and after the CER was formed, straight after the Second World War, a few years after the Second World War, I should say, and Rabbi Aaron Schuster, who was one of the founders with Israel Brody, took place in Amsterdam, and we visited his shul and so on whilst the conference was going on. And during the course of the conference, there were many people there from all over Europe. And there were several minyanim, and it went on for a long time. Every time there was a minyan, there was dinners, and there was this and that and the other. So at one point during the conference, there was a small group of English rabbis there, probably about 7 or 8 from Manchester and the Northwest, and a few from London, and they decided to go and make their own minyan, because we wanted to go, it was already late, wanted to go, so this was deemed the Brexit minyan, because all the English rabbis were going off to make their own minyan on their own. So, in the topic of the DNA, so if you'd like to pass around here, there's some Makoros on a sheet, which you can toss it, don't mind. So, if we take the subject, just take it that I put it on the top of the sheet as well, to understand that what I'm saying is not a definitive halacha, okay? It's not a comprehensive treatment of a very, very big subject. It's a very, very big subject, as you're going to see. So, it's just a general view, an introduction to the ideas of how DNA impacts on halacha. So what does DNA mean? What is DNA? So DNA is taken from any part of our bodies. It can be taken from hair, from skin, from any part of our bodies. And around 50 years ago, Crick and Watson, who were two great scientists, discovered the idea of DNA, that there is within the human body an exclusive pattern of cells. It's made up of chemicals. I'm not going to make it all into a complicated thing. It's a complicated subject, but there are chemicals within the human body, and every single person, apart from purely identical twins, has a unique DNA. There's a genetic code which is called ACGT, and the string of this code is the unique nature of every human being. So 99.9% of our DNA is the same, as everyone's DNA is the same, but 0.1% of our DNA is different. And the only two people, the only time that is the same for anybody else is in identical twins. So with everybody else, there is a way through science, through chemical experiment, doing these tests, which is now well-established methods of analysis, of proving who a person is and who his parents were, etc. And it's a really important thing, as we're going to see. It can really prove a lot of different things. So, and it's something where It's called restriction analysis, which basically means you can narrow it down who a person is and who his parents were. You can narrow it down to literally 7.5 trillion to one, something of that order, or even higher numbers. And therefore, you can imagine how important this is. So it's used very often in crime, solving crimes, and so on. But how does it impact on halacha? Where does it come into halacha? In many areas. I saw somebody speaking about this, said that the Medrash Rabbah at the beginning of Esther, the Targum at the beginning of Esther says that it says, Lo'ira'av l'alechem v'lo'itzom al'amayim. It says at the time before Mashiach there will be a thirst for knowledge. And I saw somebody explain this idea that at the time before Mashiach there will be halachic issues which have never ever been even imagined before in the history of Jewish people. They've never come across before. Because there's some concepts which just simply were not known in that sense to people. Perhaps they were known to a few, but they weren't well known. And this is why we have to have very great people who have tried to work through the concepts, as it were. And we'll perhaps later on discuss a few tshuva of Rav Osher Wise. He's one of the leading world experts in this. The Minchas Osher is one of the leading experts in this subject for a deep understanding of the science and a deep understanding of the halacha. So, for example, where might this matter? How can you identify? First of all, the obvious example of Yerusha. Somebody comes along, we know there's famous Gemaras, which tell us in Baba Basra, a man says on his deathbed, this is Zer B'ni B'chori. The Torah gives him a koach to say that this was my son. He lived a life with three sons, and then just before he dies, he says there's a man in such and such a place, and that is my son. And that's derived from a posuk, from Yakir. It can be Makir, it can say who his son is. But then somebody will come along and say, well, actually, I'm also one of the sons. I'm entitled to a share of the Yerusha. Paternity, very important issue in Kahuna. Okay, there's a tshuva of Minchas Osher we might come back to, of a man who was muchzak to be a Kohen. His father, this is a tshuva, a contemporary tshuva. He was muchzak to be a Kohen, and his father obviously was a Kohen, and he fell for a Gerusha. He wanted to marry a Gerusha. So, of course, he was told he can't get married, he can't marry the Gerusha. And then his mother said, the father had already passed away, and his mother said, actually, I need to tell you that he wasn't really your father. That your father, that you was from an artificial process, and he wasn't really your father, so therefore you're not a Kohen at all. You're not actually a Kohen, so therefore on basis of what she said, he could have been he could marry a Gerusha, he wasn't a Kohen. However, it's not simple as that, as you can imagine. He was muchzak as a Kohen. So this tshuva, this child came to Rav Osher Wise, who, what he writes in that tshuva will help us to understand some of the issues. That's a DNA would have established beyond any doubt. They could have taken DNA from the father. There's another issue there of going to the grave of Nivul Hames. Maybe we'll come to that in a minute. Of taking DNA from the father and establishing. In fact, I think he mentioned in the tshuva that they did do it anyway, and they established that he wasn't the father. He wasn't the father. So the question is, does the muchzak of halacha go against the DNA? How does that work? It's almost irrefutable scientific proof. Next question, yibum and chalitza. Same situation. Does somebody have a chiv yibum? There's a son. Is he the son? Isn't he the son? That can also be. Another question that's been dealt with in contemporary tshuvas, maintenance. A person that's claiming, somebody's claiming maintenance for a daughter. Father's got to keep his daughters. Is she really his daughter or not? Question. He disputes the fact that it's his daughter. Ishus, very, very important. I'll take you through one in a minute, a tshuva which was dealt with following 9/11 with the DNA. Agunas, very, very important. And the last one, the one that really I introduced with Bar, is the question of Jewish identity. Of people who come forward and say, they are Jewish. They know their grandmother was Jewish. This is Jewish, that's Jewish. We have to know. We can prove through DNA whether they may be Jewish or not, as we're going to see in a second. So therefore it has a lot of real implications for in halacha and deciding issues. So let's just now speak with, before we go into the question of the pure Jewish identity, let's speak about what has been discovered following the DNA, discovery of DNA around 50 years ago, and the ideas and the development, how that science has developed. Something else has developed more recently, and this is called the mitochondrial line. That is, it's known colloquially as the Eve gene. So the Eve gene means there is a gene, there's one part of the DNA which only comes from the mother. And that has a huge impact in this question of whether a person is Jewish. because we can know for almost an absolute fact from the Eve gene whether, if we know the mother was Jewish, we know that person was Jewish, and even beyond that, as we're going to see. So if you look on page 3, I've extracted a piece from that was written about the Jewish gene by a non-Jewish person, a geneticist. So as we know, Judaism is inherited down the female line, and this is a mitochondria. This is the mitochondria. That's the female, the Eve gene. Their DNA shows that today's Jews are from the largest group, 8 million Ashkenazim, most of whom have found their home in Central and Eastern Europe, and who now represent the majority of American Jews, have very few grandmothers. Around half descend from 4 women who bear the mitochondrial types, which are almost found exclusively in that population. 2 million trace their descent from just one of those ancient predecessors. So actually, this is incredible, but that's what science has told us, and the science isn't actually disputed. Rav Asher Weiss discusses there may be some marginal cases when it may be that we're not clear for whatever reason there's been some interference, but whatever. And generally speaking, the science is clear. In 1650, there were only 100,000 Ashkenazim in Europe, a number then reduced by further pogroms. In 18th century Central Europe, through a massive expansion of the population, largely because of good living conditions, in Frankfurt, Jewish life expectancy was 48 compared to 37 amongst non-Jews. That's just there to show us how Jews expanded in Europe. By 1800, there were 2 million, and by 1900, almost 4 times as many, as we know, before the Holocaust. As a result, the majority of today's Ashkenazim derive from a small proportion of that population. 2 million come from one mother, quite literally from a quote shared Eve, who probably lived unknown and recognised in an affluent household in a German or Polish village 3 centuries ago. So we can know that from this mitochondrial gene, and therefore that has a huge impact on this question. If we can show that someone has the Jewish Eve gene, then we know that on the face of the science, you might say, right, on the face of the science, the halacha, as we'll see, doesn't take that so straightforward, but on the face of the science, you could prove that person was Jewish. Okay, so let's go a little bit into that now, into the Indian of the Jewish identity and how we do that. That's the basis of...
Yeah. Not too difficult. Go on. Is it possible to have the same gene going back hundreds and hundreds of years, so there's a connection there?
Yeah.
But could there not be a broken, could not a non-Jewish person have got into that gene being transferred?
Not the mitochondrial gene, no.
No.
That only can only come through the mother.
True.
That's absolutely right to say that on the male genes, on the Y chromosome, it's different. Okay, that's the whole issue with Cohen, whether you can prove someone's a Cohen. It's not fail-safe. But on the female, as far as I know the science, you can't. It's always only comes through the mother. It's totally matrilineal. And that's why it makes a difference. So let's discuss, let's go through a few examples. A very interesting Gemara. It's a Gemara in Pesachim. The Gemara in Pesachim speaks about, it's right at the beginning of Pesachim, and it speaks about a story which happened there at the time of the Gemara. And it says there, Gimel Amud Beis, it says there as follows, that there was a certain non-Jew who travelled to Yerushalayim regularly for Pesach, and he was impersonating a Jew. He wasn't Jewish, but he impersonated Jews, and he took part in the Korban Pesach, okay, which is, of course, V'chol Orel Noyachal Boy. He's not allowed to take part. And yet, it seems, for the time, if you look at the Gemara, that the Chachamim accepted him. He was accepted there. Until Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra intervened. And they set a trap for him. They said, have you eaten from the Aliyah? It's a famous Gemara, something which he couldn't have done. And eventually he was discovered as being a fraud. I think he was killed in the end as being a fraud. Yeah, it was killed in the end, yeah. Okay, so the question is, in that Gemara, why did the Chachamim believe him at that time? He came along and said, I'm a Jew. He made out he was a Jew. And they didn't demand proof of his Jewishness. It seems they didn't believe it, right? So does that seem, to suggest that somebody comes along and says, I'm Jewish, you should believe them. It's possible you believe them. Okay? So Tosfos there says the following. Mikam ein raya. Says Tosfos, there's no raya there. Right, that we can believe anyone who comes in front of us. But oh man, he says Yisrael ani. You can't prove it from here on the face of it. Tosfos obviously have the same issue. How can we accept that accept that he was Jewish up till the intervention of Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra? So Tosfos have the same question. And says, can't say that. Deshani Hacha, says Tosfos, why is this different? De Rov Yisrael Hayu. Because there was a Rov Yisrael, V'ozlin on Bosa Rubah. And we're following the majority in Yerushalayim at the time of Pesach. There was a clear majority of Jewish people. And therefore, that proves that there's no proof that you can accept somebody because there was a rove. So if there's a rove there, then that seems to be a normal thing to do at that particular time. Whether it would have been different that if he would have come along and said, I want to marry a Jewish woman, okay, and he had to go through all the bedikah, that's a different thing. That's the Gemara, the Mishnah, the Kiddushin. I mean, the way we apply for a marriage assume it's the same, Machzik Adas, through the chief rabbi's office, it's extremely scrutinized intensely, that part of the, you can't get anything past them. Chas v'Shalom, we'd want to, but you can't. It's scrutinized intensely. But just on the face of saying he was a Jew, he wouldn't be believed normally, but because of Rov Yisrael. That seems to be that Rav isn't part of it. So Rav Osher Wise, when he's discussing these questions, he brings in that Rav is a part of it. Okay, then he throws in a complication. He says, how do you establish the Rav? And when he spoke in Amsterdam, he kind of didn't go into this because it didn't fit into the time scale. But it's just an interesting throw in to another discussion. What happens if Rove becomes one of the deciding factors? We'll see. It's not the most crucial, but if it's one of the factors that's involved, what happens if you have a town? You go with the town. We're all familiar with the Gemaras where they speak about a Rove of a city. Most people are being Jewish in the town. What happens if you have most people in the town are not Jewish, but you have a nursing home in the town where they're all Jews? So does the Rove change because of the situation where now the way people live in are different within the town? So say somebody, you've now got a Rubah Lefonenu, a man in there, right, and he says he's Jewish, okay? He says he's Jewish, but the town is not Jewish. Okay, nursing homes, I don't think, would make such investigations. As long as you pay the fees, I think they're happy to take them in. I don't know. I wouldn't like to comment further. But it's a very interesting. So he throws in, he says, what is called the Rove in that situation? So you wanted to say anything? He just throws it in as a discussion. Is the Rove the town? Is the Rove? You've got these people, they never go out of the nursing home. They're there for 10 years. They never go out. So what's the Rubah Lefonenu? Interesting shayla that he threw in. There's another Gemara in Pesachim. In Yevamos. The Gemara in Yevamos in Acholet says the following. Okay, there was the Gemara says at the bottom there in Tomer Rabbana, Misha Bav Ama Ger Ani. A person comes along and says, I was a Ger. Yochol Nekablo, shall we accept him? So Talmud Loma Itcha, B'muchzuk Kloch. It's got to be Muchzuk Kloch. The aid of Imai. And he's got to have some Eidos. He's got to have Eidos that he is a Ger. Right, minayin Talmudaim v'chiyago itcha ger ba'aretzchem, eini ela ba'aretz b'chutz la'aretz minayin. How do we know this? Talmudaim itcha. We learn it from the word itcha b'chol makom sh'ata. So the Gemara says, im came out Talmudaim ba'aretz. Why does it say ba'aretz? Ba'aretz sorech lahavi raya b'chutz la'aretz ein sorech lahavi raya. Dibre Rabbi Yehuda. That's Rabbi Yehuda. V'chachamim omrim. The chachamim say. Bein ba'aretz, bein chutz la'aretz, sorich lahavi raya. He's got to bring a proof that he's a ger. So how does he prove that he's a ger? What's the raya? What is the raya beyond any doubt in the Torah? What raya are we speaking about? What's the raya? Sorry? No, now, let's speak about those days. No certificates, right? Nowadays, a certificate, that's a din in shtoros, I've put that there. There may be an emoris in shtoros from a based din, that's a different point. But in those days, how would you prove something? It's next week, etc., the week after. What does it say? Adim. You have to have Barhuva Adov Imai. You've got to have Adim with the person. And that, in the end, shows that a person is a ger. Shomanu, Amar Rav Sheish, is to Amri, the Adim say, Shomanu, Sheniskaya Bevestin. We know, we heard, we saw proper Eidos that he was Niskaya in Bevestin. Okay? And that seems to be, and then the Gemara goes further, discusses Ba'aretz and not Ba'aretz. And that's one of the main sources that tells us that when somebody comes along, I mean, it's maybe arguable to be slightly different because he says, I'm Niskaya. It doesn't say I was Jewish, it says I was Niskaya. That's another issue. But on the face of the Gemara seems to be saying that you've got to have Adim to prove. Adim are needed to prove that a person is Jewish, to show that it has Jewish identity. So the question is then, this is the real issue, and it seems from all the contemporary poskim, as will develop, that we can't push away this halacha, because the Torah has given us a giloy, that this is the way in which we solve these kinds of problems. But we know there are other areas of halacha where we don't need two edim. What are they? Example, when would we not need two edim? Anyone? Sorry? Chazaka. What's the situation there? We wouldn't need two edim. Sorry? Yeah, well, we wouldn't need to establish something. Sorry? Sorry? Nay, he's a son, okay. What about something like agunas? Okay, there's a whole area of halacha which is in the issue of agunas, right? Where we know for a fact, okay, that we do accept edus of a different kind, right? So whether you describe it as umdana, simonim, or you put it into one of the categories. So this is where we perhaps start to make a distinction between somebody who's coming along claiming Jewish identity and then using DNA to prove his Jewish identity, where it seems clear from the Gemara that you can't do that. That's the only way you can do it is by edus. And I'll explore that in a second. And other areas where it may be that DNA can be used as part of the equation in working out. So the following question came to Rabbi Zalman Nechemia Goldberg. This is an issue of agunas, but just to show you how it was used. This was in April 2002, so it was about 8 or 9 months after 9/11. There was a man who in the tshuva, is in the letter, he's known as LK. He was on the 96th floor of the North Tower. You know the story? You've heard the story? Yeah, he was on the 96th floor of the North Tower. Don't think everybody does, so if you don't mind, I'll say it, okay? And as far as we know, there were no survivors above the 92nd floor. The impact was between 83 and 92, and there was no survivors above 92. His office was on the 96th floor. He rarely ever phoned his wife from home, right, from where he was, from the work, sorry. He never phoned his wife, rarely phoned his wife. And he was muchzer. The muchzer, one of the chazakas discussed, is that he always went to work at the same time every day. Okay, so we know from the facts, Rabbi Zalman Nechemia wrote down the facts, that at 8:17 that morning, they know that he got the underground, because they got the credit card reference for the underground, and he should have been in his office at 8:45. The impact on the North Tower was 8:46. Okay, so around 9 months later, they found two bones in that where they believe was from that part of the building. And they found two bones. I think it was part of a shoulder, another part of bone, and they tested the DNA, and they matched it with his toothbrush. They went to his house, and they took his toothbrush that he used on the morning of the 9/11, and they matched it with his toothbrush. Yeah? And that, so the question came to Rav Zalman Nechemia, and the question was, that the DNA was, it was one in a trillion chance that this could have been somebody else. So his wife was on the face of it, was an aguna. And it, very interesting, the way he explores the question, okay, is that in the end, right, the real question, there's a Gemara which says it's in Shulchan Aruch, of course, as well, where somebody falls into a boiling cauldron, and you see him falling into the cauldron, but then because of the heat temperature of the cauldron, there's nothing there. There's nothing to find. So in agunas, you can make an assumption that he must have died. Right, in that situation. So,
Aculus was their flight conference from New York, and they found an arm, but they said based on the fact they got on the plane, they saw on the plane, okay, and the DNA of the arm was enough to write it.
Oh. So what Yossi says is very good. That seems to be similar, except for one thing. Rav Zalman Nechemia said, what was the issue here? What was the issue? Did he actually get to work? In those cases, we know that he got onto the plane, and there's nowhere else he could have gone in between. And here, the last thing we know, he left home and he bought the underground ticket, and then we don't know any more, because we don't know. There was no signing in, as far as we know, at the office. Nobody who saw him could have survived. So we don't have any edus of the fact that it was that he actually got to that situation. So therefore, there's story of the cauldron doesn't help. There's also that Gemara about, I forget his name, sorry? Yeah. And then there's the Gemara about the man who runs into the building, I forget the Amora's name, he runs into the building, he sees the sword dripping with blood, and he sees him standing over the body, but he says, I can't bring you to baste it. Why? Because that is Dinei Nefoshos. Okay? So in Dinei Nefoshos, that kind of proof is not acceptable. It's got to be our Pishnai Meidim, which is what I put on there on that first page. Okay? That in Dinei Nefoshos, it's got to be, again, our Pishnai Meidim Yokum Dova. So that's clear. But in Agunas, Rav Zalman Nechemya, in the end, Paskin, that this person could rely on this, together with all the other evidence. So the DNA there was a sniff to the other things, all the other bits of evidence that they were in Agunas. Because we try and find, despite what people say about, criticize the Rabbonim and say they don't try to help Agunas, that's not true. It's actually factually not correct. There's so much been written, as many of you will know, after the Holocaust and after all the disasters, that so much effort has been made to try and be matter Agunas wherever possible within the context of Halacha, and this was one of them. So this is a case where you could use DNA. So in this case, it was something, it's part of an equation, because in Agunas we know that there is more, that there's more flexibility. But that doesn't help us, as I say, in the case of establishing someone's Jewish identity, because it seems in personal status matters there's a difference between the two, a clear difference. Okay, so if we just go a little bit more, I just want to go a little bit more. Rabbi Soloveitchik explained a bit more in that Gemara. It's very interesting. He explains a bit more in that Gemara. I'm not going into the Pilpul now, but he explains there's a difference between Dovah Sheva Erva and Isurim. We know that Eidechod Ne'emon be Isurim, that's a halacha, that you can believe somebody when it comes to the questions of Kashrus, for example, and other similar things. But when it comes to Dovah Sheva Erva, Dovah Sheva Erva is very, very similar to the question of Dinei Nefoshos, except in the case of Agunas, right? So that's, he explores that chiluk between the two. He's got a beautiful pilpul on the topic, but it might help us to explain a little bit in the Gemara. So just let me now tell you something else, which is also very, very interesting. The Bedikah of Rav Sadia Gaon. Okay, so there's a famous story, it's quoted in Sefer Chassidim, the following story, going back many, many, many centuries, involving Rav Sadia Gaon. So there was a wealthy man who travelled a long distance with his wife. When he set off on his travels, his wife was expecting a baby, and his servant. Okay, the man died, and the servant then came back and presented himself as the son. Okay, so nobody knew who it was. Nobody knew, was he the son, wasn't he the son, when he came back. So the wife gave birth. And the years went by, and there was a dispute. Who was the real son? I think Marcus Lehmann wrote a book on a story. One of his stories is very, very similar to this. Itama, I think it's called. It's based on the from the time of the Churban, I think. The same kind of idea. The servant came back and claimed that he was the real Yorish of the estate. So this man, his wife came back, gave birth, and then when this child, 18 years later, this child came to Rav Sadia Gaon to say that he was the real child and that he was entitled to the estate. So what did Rav Sadia do? Rav Sadia exhumed the body of the father. I'll say this, kach nichtav b'sefer ha-chassidim. I can't go in, that's another point. I say Rav Asher Wise discusses the question of nivul ha-meis. But in this case, Rav Sadia Gaon, exhumed the body, took one of the bones from the body, and he then he took blood from the son and from the man who was the servant, and he put the bone into the blood of each of them. This is what's written. Placed the bone first into the blood of the servant and then into the blood of the son. The bone absorbed the son's blood, but not the blood of the servant. So in Rav Sadia's opinion, the identity of the true son was revealed because his father's bone absorbed his blood. And that's how he paskened. That demonstrated to Rav Sadia that there was genetic comparison between the two. So what do you make of that story? That is like almost like a DNA test. Almost like a DNA. Not quite, but it's almost like. It's not like. Whether, who knows? Who knows whether Rav Sadia was using that as a giloy? Okay, it could be. I'm just putting my own thoughts forward. Whether that was actually something we can do and it would work again, I don't know, or whether he was using that as a giloy, he knew who it was, right? And he had to find a way, a bit like the Goral Hagra, it's a way of being Megala, something which perhaps people already know, or they don't know, but somebody knows. He's finding a way of bringing out what, to prove it to people that was the case. And that's why he paskened. So then, in Eliyahu Rabbah, he asked Akash on this, the Gemara in Baba Basra, the Gemara says that there was a couple who had 10 children, but on a man's deathbed, the husband said that only one of his children was really his child. So in order to determine who was the real child, Reb Bana'a made a plan. He instructed the boys to hit their father's grave, okay, and that would reveal the identity of the true child. That's all he told them. Okay, all the boys hit the grave except for one, and the one that didn't hit him, Reb Bana'a said, that must be the real child. It's a bit like the story of Shlomo HaMelech. The real mother won't cause harm. So Reb Bana'a says, okay, that proves that he was the real child. Okay, so the question is, why didn't, if it was already known there was such a thing like Rav Sadia did, why didn't he do a similar kind of thing? So that's, again, a question. Maybe the answer was because of Nivul Hames. Maybe he didn't want to do it because it would have involved taking the body out. Okay, Rav Osher Wise also discusses this question, right? Why didn't he use it? And he says, Lo rotzo lahotzi es hames, mikvorotzo v'linivulo efsha. So he says, Shikvar hames lifnei zman. Okay, and he said it was a long time before, and therefore he couldn't do it, it wouldn't work, right? Because that somos have been nikrash and misbayish. Okay, and then he says that Efshe Shirabana klal lo shoma al badika, so he hadn't heard of such a thing. He never heard of such a thing before. And also the question, another question which arises, again, I'm putting it out there, there's more questions than answers, but I'm putting it out there, the question of, we have a halacha that we don't go looking for mamzerim, we don't go looking for him. So what would have been the effect of this, of bringing out this here, that the other 9 children would have been mamzerim, potentially? So this is discussed, Rav Osher also spoke about this in a separate session in Amsterdam, where somebody had come forward saying, telling people that a great-grandmother had in fact had a child outside of a marriage, and now 3 generations later there was a Kohel family in the Shiloh, which came to as a Kohel family in Yerushalayim, and the question was now what was their status, and basically he said you can't hear this because there's no edus, it's just somebody saying something, it's not, you can't just displace people from their, what they're muhsak to be in such a way, it wouldn't go there. So just, but we don't have to go there. Halacha is very clear. We don't go there. So he says here as well that maybe that this would not, the effect of it wouldn't be right to deal with it in such a way. And that's where Rabbana did not want to do that, and therefore he didn't go into this question. But that suggests very clearly. This is a very clear story from Sadia Gaon that there is something that we can use, or people who know how can use it. Whether that's only for people who are of Sadia Gaon is another question, but it's a very interesting predate. And this story is quoted before DNA came along. 50, 60 years ago, then the just simple blood tests, right? So blood tests were used to determine paternity, but they weren't as clear. When my early years in law, I used to do paternity disputes, and we used to go for blood tests. There was no DNA available then, right? It was blood tests. Blood tests are not as conclusive. They became more conclusive as the years went by, but it's nowhere near the same as a DNA. So, for example, in Sitz Eliezer's got a tshuva, all the around his time discussed this question of blood tests, can we rely on blood tests? And the answer was basically no, that they can't rely on blood. This is not the way the Torah said, therefore we can't rely on blood tests. So that's that part of it. Now, just want to finish off really with a very, very fascinating Oracle Shulchan. What I'd like to do maybe at some other time was speak about the matrilineal side of it. We've not really gone into that much about the mother's side and why that's the case. But there's a very interesting Oracle Shulchan. There's an Oracle Shulchan, just let me find it. Oracle Shulchan in Yeridea, Simon Pei Dalad. He's speaking about an interesting topic. Shamati shebechol mini mayim v'yichud b'mei gishomim molei beruim dakim. So the Aruch HaShulchan said, I've heard, he's speaking about bugs in liquids and vegetables. So he says, I've heard that in all kinds of water that's full of all sorts of creatures inside the water. She'ein ha'ayin yecholo liroisom. Right, which you can't see. U'v'yaldusi, says the Aruch HaShulchan, shamati mipi echad shahoyu b'merachokim. Okay, somebody came from, it was some way away. So what we'd call a microscope, a glass which enlarges the picture. Admaoid, kirivovois pa'omim, thousands of times. Bemayim, kol mini habruim, and you look into the mouth, you see all these dozens of little creatures. I mean, apart from the fact, never mind the question of Issa, would you really want to drink the water? The best water in the world, Manchester water, right? Would you still want to drink it? Lefizeh, ein anu shoisi mayim, says Aruch HaShulchan, we never drink water. Sheri enu habruim, nishavu b'mekorim, and therefore they would seem to be of the situation of the bugs that we're not allowed to eat, says the Aruch HaShulchan. Ha emes hi, the Torah is only asks what you can see. Torah wasn't given to Malachim. So he says, many of the scientists, because you open your mouth, let some air in, you're going to swallow a load of bugs. Maybe we shouldn't have us. Elavada to Hakol Yifta PM the Ain Kain the Im Kain Ain Hu. Kivin Sh Ain Ha Ain Shoilet Behem Lav Klumhi. So he says, Omnom Kamo Kemosha Ain Yocholirois Afilo Neger Hashemesh, if you can see it with improved light, that's he says is okay. Afilo Dak Minadak, who Sheretz Gomel. So one of the in America, or Schachter, wrote that maybe he just not pulling this as an absolute, but he just says maybe this is something that really goes to the heart of the whole issue, right? That is it something that we are supposed to go into? Are we supposed to be doing this with the DNA? Because the Torah has been megalot in certain ways of solving these. In a way, it's a gila. The whole thing, I was speaking to somebody about it, I was speaking to my son about it, about the whole dinner of Edim. It's really a giloy. Because we know that Edim could concoct a story, and it's quite possible that they could tell the story in such a way that they get through. And we know that it's happened. So the Torah says, Hashem says, this is the way I want you to sort out the dispute. And it seems that with status, if there are no other tznifim, then just the DNA itself wouldn't help. That seems to be the bottom line. You can't rely on the DNA to prove Jewish status. You can use it in other areas of halacha, but as a tznif, as part of a process, but for this, not on its own. Because the Torah has told us this is the way you want to do it. And what the eye doesn't see, it seems as though maybe, he suggests, that's what we can't go into. There's lots of areas of halacha where we know we don't go beyond the naked eye. For example, the Sefer Torah. He quotes, example of the Sefer Torah, two letters touching each other. You think the letters are, if they're touching, then it's possible. If they're not touching, it's not possible. Are you required to get a magnifying glass out to look? No. You call somebody, you have a look, and you see, do you think it's touching or not touching? So there are certain things that we've only got defined processes for dealing with. Once we get beyond those processes, maybe we don't have to go any further than that. So that's another aspect to it. But as I say, it seems at the moment where it's clear that we don't rely on the DNA to establish Jewish identity on its own. Certainly not on its own. Okay? It may be that, he says, that other cases where there's lots of other pointers in one direction, that's for Paiskim to decide on each individual basis.
Interesting case going on in Spain at the moment. Gaudi. Probably an illegitimate daughter. Nobody's quite sure at the moment, but they're going to exhume his body to do a DNA check. Yeah. She would be. You heard about that?
That's a question, but there's a whole thing with Spanish jury, because with Spanish jury, there's much more mixed in the Muranos. This is what I said, it was only about Ashkenazi jury. Spanish and Portuguese are much more problems, and also whether you're allowed to exhume a body or not is a big question.
That's another story. I don't think he was Jewish, but there's a case going on. Thank you.
Go ahead.